I think great leaders understand that they're always trying to replace themselves. And if you are not approaching it that way, if you're trying to hold on because it's your baby or you want your footprint on it or whatever the reason, you're really doing the organization a disservice.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, I'm joined by Eric Tobias. In a past life, Eric was the founder and CTO of iGo Digital, which he sold to ExactTarget, which he helped sell to Salesforce. Today, Eric is a partner at High Alpha, a venture studio that conceives, launches, and scales next-generation enterprise cloud companies. It just so happens that one of the companies that High Alpha has invested in is my company, Woven. So this is a really fun conversation with someone who has gotten to know myself and my business very well. In this episode, we chat about how Eric parlayed an early love of basketball and bootleg music into a passion for the internet, then about how he grew his first team during the dot-com era, and then the lessons he learned starting and scaling iGo Digital. This conversation reminds me why I love being a founder. When Eric thinks of building a company, he thinks as a systems builder. He's addicted to tightening feedback loops and finding ways to engineer himself out of processes. As leaders, we're often the bottleneck. And now, here's my conversation with Eric Tobias. Eric Tobias, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Happy to be here, Wes. Thanks for having me.
So what got you into building software originally?
I was always a curious kid as it relates to computers and technology. I was kind of one of the first in my peer group to have a computer in our house. And so I was very interested in the beginning. And then when I got to college, I got really into music and I wanted to record and trade bootlegs of live shows. And of course, this is back in the day before, you know, digital music. And so the way that I would find bootlegs to trade was via the internet. And I was at Indiana University at the time and they had just rolled out, you know, browsers on all the computers at school. And so I needed to figure out a way to build a website in order to share my music and to find others' music. And so that kind of led me down the road of learning the code.
Was that like Mosaic browser back in the like OG browser?
It was OG, man. Yeah, it was Mosaic. And then early on, you know, early versions of Netscape. I remember Netscape going from 1.0 to 1.1. it was rough, but it was cool.
So you wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for your desire to pirate music. That's what I'm hearing. So you got into computers.
Yeah, the live experience, but yes, there was some pirating going on.
Yeah, that's fair. That's more authentic. You're in the actual concert. So you get into computers that way. And what's kind of the biggest inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
Yeah, so when I was at IU, I was working at an ad agency, and one of our clients was Indiana University's basketball coach, Bob Knight, who's a very kind of larger-than-life persona and profile.
He's a well-known.
Well-known guy, and he wanted to have a website made, and so we did that at the agency. And my job on an ongoing basis was to take his post-game press conference and put it on online. And I would kind of sit there in the basement of this agency and wait for the comments to come in, and the comments from Coach Knight. And I would have that kind of on one screen. And then on the other screen, I would have some analytics of all the people that were on the site at that moment in time. And, you know, Coach Knight was sometimes very prompt in his press conference and sometimes was very delayed. And so I'd have some time to just sit there and kind of look at what was going on. And I remember thinking how amazing it was that I was going to type some stuff into the computer. I was going to push a button and I was going to, you know, submit these comments out to the internet. And while I pushed that button, there were these hundreds, if not thousands of people that were waiting to consume that content. And, you know, as a 18, 19 year old kid, I felt very powerful in that moment that I all of a sudden had a conduit to various countries and various types of people that otherwise I wouldn't. And so I really got struck by the power of the internet through that experience. And I, as a kid, I always had this kind of dual mind of ones and zeros and then and then really having a passion for design. And, you know, early on building websites, it fueled my ability to tap into both sides of my brain. So, I took that Bob Knight experience and, you know, started a business around, setting up websites for other companies and just started to try to tap into that passion.
This was back in the days before Dreamweaver and any kind of, like, if you wanted to build something, you were hand coding it and, you know, walking uphill both ways, and you had to be a designer and developer. Is that kind of the feel of things?
That definitely captures it. You know, there were several things that I think we got right in the early days of the internet. One of them was view source. You know, so a lot of it was pulling out an editor or a notepad, I guess, is what I used most of the time, and, you know, just figuring it out.
Yeah, so you really enjoyed building things, creating things, designing things. What was the point where you transitioned into leading teams to build things together?
Yeah, so after I started this this website design and development company right out of school, one of my clients, they were in the automotive battery business, and they wanted to build a website. So my company built them a website, and it was a terrible disaster because they wanted to sell these car batteries online, and of course nobody wanted to buy car batteries online back in 1998. But what we did discover was that there was an audience out there looking for a different kind of battery, and that was specialty types of batteries. So cell phones and laptops and camcorders and those kind of things. And so I decided to shut my business down, and they decided to shut their business down. And we started a new business together that was called batteries.com. And we started that in 1999. And so I was the, you know, I started in that business as of course one of the founders, but I also started as our chief technologist and was doing a lot of the coding. And as that business started to get some traction, as we raised venture capital, I quickly went from the primary development resource to, you know, to leading a team of engineers.
How did that transition go for you? What are some things that you learned the hard way when you went from, you know, opening up an editor and building to helping your team build software?
Boy, I made a lot of mistakes. I learned a ton. I had never really hired engineers before. I made the bad assumption that all engineers were like me, or all people that could code were like me. And of course, that's, you know, you say it now and that's silly, but, you know, at the time it made sense for whatever reason. I think we were in such hyper growth mode that I did not understand the pain that comes with hiring a C player versus an A player. And how difficult and expensive that is to unwind. That was something I really learned kind of the hard way and trial by fire. You know, just the overall process was something that was new to me. So the idea of doing a code sample or a code review together, you know, I had to learn a lot of that stuff by making a mistake of not doing it in order to understand the importance of doing it.
That's how I learned the hard way. It teaches you pretty well.
Yes, it does.
So now you've transitioned up a couple ladders where you're building a business as a founder, and now as a venture capitalist where you're helping people build businesses. What do you miss about running a business that you don't get whenever you're helping people run businesses?
Probably what you referred to there. I mean, when you're building a business or when you're running a business, the tightness of the feedback loop is addicting. So you have a goal, whatever that goal may be. It's, I want to hit this much in ARR, or I want to deliver my new product, or I want to add a new customer, whatever it may be. And you're able to very easily understand, did I achieve that or did I not? And that momentum, either positive or negative, you know, changes your next move or your future behavior. And, you know, I think the further you get away from operating a business, the more you have to kind of hack that feeling into your daily existence. So as a venture capitalist, I mean, I'm still very much involved in company building and what we do at High Alpha, but you're right. I mean, it's not the same as being the CEO. And I think the biggest adjustment I had to make in the first year was just how to engineer that feeling of winning or not winning. Because venture capital is a long game. You know, it's a 10, 15 year game for every investment. So unlike being able to put up a scoreboard, you're working towards a different goal.
And how have you engineered that that feeling of winning or not winning?
Yeah, there's some things you of course can look at the company level. So is the company achieving its goals, whatever those may be? And that certainly is one way. We've really tried to instrument our studio and our capital portfolio in a way where we are getting reporting metrics on a very frequent basis to understand the pulse of the business. One of the things that we encourage all of our leaders to do, our CEOs in particular, is to send a Friday note, as we call it, or some do it on a weekend, some do it on Monday. You know, the day is not important, but a weekly update to their team. And by team, we mean, you know, employees, partners, investors, and everybody who's in the boat with them, and just update them on what's happening in the business. And it's amazing how that level of communication creates intimacy between the stakeholders, and you feel like, you know, you're in the business. I also think there's a direct correlation between those that do that and their level of success, because that rigor forces you to stop and pause and take notice of, what did I get accomplished? How did that map to my goals? What am I missing out on? And it's very easy, especially in a startup, to just get moving with the river and let the tide take you away versus being thoughtful about it.
I had an insight while you were talking. I'm a big proponent of continuous delivery and small incremental progress. And I write one big email update that is really hard, and I'm writing it right now and I'm struggling. And I need to write smaller updates more often. My life would be easier. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, your life would be easier, and everybody that's rooting for you would, you know, you'd be more top of mind. And it's a good parallel between continuous delivery and CEO communication.
Yeah. It's like if something's hard, you can either avoid it or you can do it more often and get better at it. And I think I'm at the point I need to get better at it. And I think probably all of us that lead teams, there's probably some parallel there about how we do communication.
For sure.
So you founded iGo Digital, which you sold to ExactTarget, which then helped sell to Salesforce for billions of dollars. So you've experienced several levels of scale throughout your career, and you've seen other companies do it. You personally, what is the biggest scaling challenge you faced on the product and engineering side of things?
The iGo Digital business was a predictive content engine for retailers. So we would instrument a retailer's website with a snippet of JavaScript, or they would make an API call to us, and we would ingest all of the traffic from their site. Every click would come into our system. And we early on had a couple of really major customers. So our very first customer was Best Buy. And one of our first five customers was Walmart. And so we had massive amounts of web traffic hitting our systems. And originally, we had architected our system in a way where we were reliant on SQL as our data store. And we were fine from a read perspective, but from a write perspective, it was very challenging. And so we ended up, this was back in 2007, so 12 years ago, which sounds like a long time.
In internet years, it is.
Yeah, it is. We ended up moving to a brand new database called MongoDB, which of course now is widely used, but we were one of Mongo's first probably 25 customers, and ended up being a very good strategic bet for us because the benefits of Mongo really played nicely with our use case. But that was a very difficult time because we had signed these customers up. We had a solution that worked, but all of a sudden their traffic was so much that our systems couldn't keep up. And so they lost some confidence in us. Our team didn't necessarily know how to fix the problem. It was a scale that, you know, that our group had never seen before. So that was challenging.
So at that time, you had a head of engineering, or were you playing the CTO role?
No, I had a head of engineering, a guy named Matt Kaufman, and Matt kind of in an act of desperation that I now think was total planned brilliance. He decided that he was going to, you know, head out to San Francisco for a week, and he knew some folks out there and wanted to kind of chat with him about the problems we were facing. And this is a true story. Ironically, he was in a coffee shop, and he overheard two folks from Twitter talking about how they were using Mongo. And we were not familiar with Mongo or had really, you know, hadn't come across it. And that conversation sparked Matt to, you know, learn about Mongo and then ultimately select that. And within a matter of day, you know, within a matter of days, we were kind of up and rolling and had some things figured out that ended up being really saving the business, quite frankly.
So thinking about you're in Matt's shoes and what did he do well to actually solve that problem? Like, I imagine there's some internal communication there. I imagine everyone's pretty stressed out if you've got Walmart as a customer and they're not happy. What did you write there that we can maybe learn from other than go to San Francisco and pick a random coffee shop? Which,
yeah.
It's not the only story I've heard where that's the solution.
I know. Some magic happens sometimes. Yeah, I think the great lesson for me in that is that when you're an entrepreneur, you're building a business and you run into a roadblock, which inevitably everyone does and fairly frequently, I think there's two responses when that happens in life. One is to, you know, let fear creep in and sort of get paralyzed, but not knowing what to do. And the other is just to take action. And it almost doesn't matter what that action is, but taking action, because when you have momentum, it leads you places and things naturally begin to happen and it takes you down different paths. And Matt was very good at that. And I think that was a key part of our overall learning at IGO Digital. We were in a space where we had a lot of well-funded competitors, but we were very scrappy and very customer focused. And it was all about this idea of action. And I think that's important on the engineering side too, because you get stuck into solving certain problems or you get in kind of ruts where you're doing things the same way and you gotta find ways to break out of that. And oftentimes just taking an action is the first step.
Try something, run some experiments.
Exactly.
So you've seen in the high alpha portfolio, you've seen companies at different stages, you know, seed and series A and series B, different growth rates. Thinking about the inflection points of scale, I'm thinking here about, you know, when you go from one team to two and two to three and you're organizational, what are some common mistakes that you see companies make?
I think generally the big mistake that happens when you're moving from, call it one engineer to two or one team to two, is just thinking that the process that you've been running is the process you should keep running. There are, you know, this was a big learning for me over my career, that there are things that work to get you from point A to point B. Sometimes those things work from point B through point N, but oftentimes not. And knowing when to evaluate those things is not always obvious. But I think the kind of the thing that I've used as a guidepost to that is when you're bringing folks on and you're onboarding them and they don't immediately understand the process or don't immediately understand why, that's a signal that it may be time to review things. One of the things that we struggled with at IGO Digital when we were scaling, we scaled very quickly from maybe what's called a handful of employees to over 50 in about a year and a half or 2 years. And one of the things that was a challenge for us, because about half of those folks were engineers, was just our overall onboarding process. You know, things were very lightly documented, of course. And this actually led to a business creation. So Lessonly was, you know, part of the use case of Lessonly came out of this problem.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But kind of looking back, and I see this now with you know, the companies that we're involved with here at High Alpha, you know, if you're not preparing for that scale, even just architecturally, and by architecturally, I mean organizationally, or the architectural organization, you know, you can be very unprepared for it. And then you begin to hire people to overcome that scale problem, and you're putting resource on top of a very wobbly foundation. So getting that foundation up front is really important.
So thinking about the common things that people they do from A to B, but it doesn't get you from B to C. What are some of those things that typically have to change from B to C?
I think one of the things is, you know, the role of product management. So I see a lot of companies go from founder vision with an engineer or a couple of engineers executing that vision to now the founder getting pulled into a lot more responsibilities across the business. And you have a lack, you have a gap then that's created for that engineering team in terms of vision and in terms of prioritization. And so, you know, filling that gap with strong product management, product leadership is really critical. That's definitely one thing. You know, two, I see teams organizing themselves by and large, too large of a footprint. You know, when you get to the point where you've got 15, 20, 25 engineers, it's easy to say, well, let's create two teams of 10. That's just too big. You know, getting smaller pods of resources, I think is much more beneficial. And then attaching multi-disciplines in those pods is really important. So working with a designer, working with a product leader, you know, working with an engineer, all tightly coupled, you can move a lot faster and get a lot farther than if things get, you know, so monolithic that it can become unwieldy.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people, you know, I don't want to introduce new layers of management as a reason not to create teams. I think you're right that it's counterproductive. So let's say you're a technical founder, you realize that the kind of product vision founder is getting pulled off to other parts of the business. How do you advocate for what you need there? Because I do see companies hiring product management a little bit too late.
I think great leaders understand that they're always trying to replace themselves. And if you are not approaching it that way, if you're trying to hold on because it's your baby or you want your footprint on it or whatever the reason, you're really doing the organization a disservice and you're putting that technical leader at a real disadvantage. If you're in the technical leadership role and you're experiencing that, you know, I think using data is always a great way to illuminate some of the challenges, looking at historical information on how long sprints took or the amount of work that has been done in a given sprint or a given effort versus where things are at today. The data will tell the story that things are just elongating. And, you know, everybody wants more speed out of engineering, right? The number one question engineers get asked is how long is this going to take? But a big part of speed is focus and clarity. And if you can correlate those two for the CEO, it really illuminates the need for product management when there's a gap.
So we used to get this much work done because we were focused and we had clarity. And now we have data that says without that clarity, there's more churn. We're not getting as much stuff done.
Exactly.
It makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned cross-functional teams, having a designer embedded in that pod for engineering. So one thing I'm seeing a lot right now is a lot of talk about Marty Kagan's book, Inspired, and like the advocating for empowered cross-functional team. He compares that to kind of the feature factory model where executives and stakeholders and sales say, we need this list of features. You put them on a date-based roadmap, and then they can kind of sell to that, which is my impression of kind of the average in the industry. So thinking about those two worlds, what do you think we can learn from that? What do you think we gain from that cross-functional empowered team version of the world?
I think, you know, if I just reflect on the experiences I've had across my career, the times when I've been most successful is when I have been closest to the customer, almost regardless of role. You know, when I was the lead engineer at batteries.com, really understanding how the customer would buy our product and where their pain points were, that made me a better engineer to be able to, you know, to make some of those changes that were necessary. If you're a CEO, really understanding what the customer wants to buy and setting your teams up for success to produce what they want to buy is really important. I worked for a guy at Salesforce who had a mantra where he was a technical leader, but he would speak with a customer every single day, and he would not go home until he talked to a customer. And he was very mindful about it and very, very purposeful about it. And, you know, I think this idea of tossing features over to engineering and having those come back and building up this big roadmap, I mean, there are reasons to take that approach. But in early stage companies, and I would argue even in later stage companies as well, it just creates more friction between you and the customer. It takes you further away from the voice of truth. And what I think we're all striving for, whether you're a designer, whether you're an engineer, whether you're a product manager, we are all striving to produce something of value, something that people want to use, that they're inspired by, that they frankly can't live without. And the only way to get there is to be able to have a tight feedback loop. And we know from lots of years of organizational study that the smaller those groups are, the better that you can respond.
So you're closer to the customer, tighter feedback loop. That's the main benefit we get from those cross-functional teams.
I think there's also another huge benefit, which is you know, these different disciplines have different points of view, and they have, you know, there is no one truth. So what often happens in organizations is, you know, design wants one thing and engineering wants another, and there's this friction. And when you put people on the same team and ask them to work together as a team, and their success is driven based on being a team, you know, you see that friction turn into actual competitive advantage. And I think that's a really hidden benefit that most people overlook.
Yeah, instead of an us versus them, design versus engineering, it's design and engineering heading in the same direction.
Exactly.
I like that. And what, so let's, I think this idea is more popular among engineers maybe than it is the rest of the business. I think a lot of engineers want to get closer to the customer. They want to run more experience. So if you're an engineering leader, and let's say you're in a more traditional siloed organization, and you kind of believe all of the things you just said about the benefits, how would you kind of, you know, share that vision? Or I don't want to say make the case, but like, you know, communicate those benefits to other folks so you have more ability to do that.
I think you have to be able to articulate the benefit to the business. And I think being able to correlate speed with business value and speed with team size, you know, drawing those connections is really, really important. Regardless of whether you work in a kind of old school business or a new school business, or regardless of size, I just think that's really important. I think for organizations that have historically not worked in an agile way, this is a very different way of thinking. But there's a lot of examples out there in modern software companies that operate this way, you know, as to the benefits. And I think we're all trying to learn a better way to do something. You know, if there's a better way, I think most people broadly want to adopt that. So, you know, I think there's a lot of places to draw inspiration from these days.
Kind of shining light on some of those examples, tracing the speed you gain to business outcome, not just like the product is better or we feel better. Like it actually, you know, furthers the business.
Yeah, I think as a leader of lots of engineers over the years, I mean, that's been one of the things I've tried to pull on is understanding how to articulate, first of all, understanding, and then second, how to articulate the work that is being done to the impact on the business. I think it's easy for all of us to get hung up in building stuff and not really understanding why. And so if you're looking to make a change in your organization, I think the first thing is to understand why that change is necessary. And then work backwards to figuring out how to articulate that.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. When Eric was scaling iGo Digital, he had to hire a lot of engineers fast. That led to onboarding issues, which led to scaling issues. These aren't engineering problems, these are people problems. And I started Woven to help solve one of those people problems. How do you find more great engineering candidates? Woven owns the top of your hiring funnel, from resume to application review through vetting on technical aptitude, collaboration, and problem-solving skills. When a candidate lands on your calendar, you know they can build software, so your interviews have a much higher hit rate. If you want to learn more about how Woven can help you scale your software team, check us out at woventeams.com. Eric, could you walk me through the interview that had the most lasting positive impact, positive impression of a candidate?
You know, one that comes to mind is an engineer that we hired at iGo Digital that, you know, this person was just so positive, but so candid. So, you know, oftentimes in an interview, I think all of us are trying to put our best foot forward and we're trying to really read the tea leaves on what the organization may be looking for. You know, what always strikes me is when people in a very positive manner reveal a vulnerability that, you know, maybe conventional wisdom would tell you to not reveal. And in this case, you know, I don't want to give too many details, but in this case, that this individual was just had some challenges in their life. And probably conventional wisdom would have been to maybe not bring those up in an interview. Maybe those could have been looked upon as a potential negative. I took it just the opposite. I thought this person was so confident in themselves that they were able to share that. And it was part of them. It was part of their story. And what that translated to me was if they were willing to do that in an interview, then when we got into a very difficult situation in the business, they were not going to be hesitant to raise their hand for help, or they were not going to be afraid to say, hey, you know, I'm stuck. I'm not sure how to figure this out. I knew they were very intelligent. I knew they were very capable. But what we're often trying to find when we're building engineering teams is not, can you figure out the technical solution to this problem? It's much more about, can you communicate with the team? Can you fit into a team? Are you going to really be good at the, you know, the softer side of being an engineer? Those are some of the harder things to look for, but they're so important.
If you had a magic wand and you could eliminate or introduce one idea about hiring from the zeitgeist, what's the idea you would add or get rid of?
If I could wave a magic wand and every person that I wanted to hire was a warm referral, that'd be amazing. You know, so often that warm referral gives you a level of confidence in making the coin flip decision. But, you know, that's not the way the world works. And so ways that we try to go about kind of hacking that are, you know, when we're making a hire, can you, you know, what can you learn from your network about that person? And, you know, the old Kevin Bacon game, I mean, really is true. We are all only a few degrees away from each other. And there's always somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody.
It's kind of like backdoor reference checks.
Yeah. In our business and in venture, that's really important. I think that's true in any business, but in our business, it's really important. Oftentimes what we're deciding on is, you know, is this CEO or this leadership team, is this somebody that we want to be a partner with for the next 10 or 15 years? And, you know, you can spend a lot of time with someone, but there's nothing like having history and being kind of in the grind with someone. So it's important to get that context.
Do you differentiate between different types of referrals? I sometimes think about, you know, a referral from, I worked with this person, he's an engineer, they're an engineer, I'm an engineer, versus like, you know, they worked in my company, I didn't do the same job, versus like, I just know this person in the community. Is there much of a difference between those?
To me, there is. And I think the referral source and the relationship you have with the referral source is ultra critical. So, you know, I could meet someone once or twice, and if they refer somebody in, that's very different than if one of my business partners refers somebody in, and I, you know, I have a just different level of trust because of different type of relationship. We've thought a lot over the last few years about, and I think a lot of people have thought a lot about how bad of a job LinkedIn does with connections. You know, you can meet someone once, and you can be best friends with someone, and to LinkedIn, it's the same because you're connected. And I think that analogy is true for referrals as well. You really have to go one or two steps further than just having a referral. It's what's the quality of the referral.
I wonder if we had better language around that. Maybe we could do a better job of describing, but I don't have any words. They're all referrals to me.
Yeah.
So what is the best hidden gem engineer you've ever hired who might have looked bad on paper if you're just kind of looking at the resumes that came in? You don't have to use specific names, but I love these stories of folks that are much better than their paper would predict.
You know, at IGO Digital, I think this was, there were a handful of things that we did really well, some of them by design, some of them by accident. And this was one that I would put in the category of we really got right. We had not raised any outside capital, so we were very conscious of resource constraint. And that sort of constraint caused us to have to be very creative in how we sourced talent. You know, if I think about our engineering team, which, you know, is maybe, I don't know, 20 people or so, 20, 25 people, probably half of them would come from a background that you would describe as unconventional. So we had a couple folks that previous job was not in engineering, that they were doing something else, and they had a close enough skill set or working knowledge that we were able to take them into our organization and make them productive. We had a couple other individuals that it was the first time ever working in a startup. They came from very large, kind of old industrial businesses, and on paper would not be right for a high growth SaaS startup. But we knew based on their personality type and, you know, kind of some of the technologies that they were using that they could be successful in our environment. And then, you know, one that just kind of stands out is we hired a gal who at the time we hired her was working on the sales floor at Best Buy, and she was hired as an intern. And today she is a software manager at Salesforce, managing a team of 40 or 50 people. And that all happened within the span of, you know, 7-8 years. And so you say, well, why is that? Or how did that happen? You know, I think there's a number of things, but it all comes down to this individual. I mean, all credit goes to her. She's, you know, very curious. She's kind of a lifelong learner. She's involved in exploring a lot of new technologies. She's a great communicator, you know, all the things that it takes to be a great engineer.
So next time someone applies with Best Buy as their most recent job, we should give them an interview. Some of them will work out. So now it's time for the rapid fire round. I'm going to ask a question and you'll give a quick response. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's do it. What's a mistake you've seen a candidate make in an interview that they didn't know they were making?
I see a lot of candidates who are interested in leadership positions backing down from their natural leadership in the interview in an attempt to demonstrate that they're a team player. In our particular business, we look and talk to a lot of CEOs. The last thing I want a potential CEO candidate to do is say, well, I'd like to be the CEO, but I'd probably be okay with being the number two. No, if you want to be a CEO, you want to be a CEO, and you need to own that.
Which are the skills that are more important for an engineer, like the hard technical skills or soft catalytic skills?
I think the soft skills are more difficult by and large, but I also think it depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. There are some very, very difficult technical challenges that, you know, can be difficult for some engineers to try to tackle. But, you know, over the course of my career, I believe the softer skills, the communication, the how to be a team player, the being a good listener is a very critical skill to being a good engineer. Being comfortable standing up at a whiteboard and working through a solution plan before writing code is very important. And those all come down to some softer skills.
What does a six-star culture edition look like for a high alpha studio? Someone's just so good, they're above 5 stars.
Wow. You know, I think for us, given the business that we're in, we start a new business every 3 or 4 months. We're building those companies from scratch. We're also investing in other companies. So you need to be athletic. You know, you need to be able to go from building a prototype that we know is going to get thrown away to talking with our engineering partners about, you know, massive scale, building systems that are going to last, and being able to switch context. So going from talking about, you know, sales technology to marketing technology to HR technology, you know, really being able to switch context is important. Have to be a great communicator. So much of what we do is talking about futuristic ideas or where we think things are headed. You have to be able to have a point of view and communicate that. I think you have to be a lifelong learner. We're trying to figure out things that don't exist. So you have to be able to correlate a lot of different pieces of information. That kind of comes down to someone who's, you know, reading a lot, they're open-minded, they're taking in inputs from a lot of different sources. I think you have to have an experimentation mentality that not everything's going to be successful, that you're going to try some things and you're going to fail, but you have to keep experimenting. You never know when that path is going to reveal itself. I think humility is a really important aspect of the culture at High Alpha, and I would say an aspect of great engineers. You know, oftentimes great engineers are the smartest person in the room, but they need to be part of a team in order to be successful. They're reliant on that team, and, you know, understanding that they're one of many is important.
My guest today has been Eric Tobias. Eric, thanks for being on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes.
Thanks again to Eric for sharing his journey. Here are a few takeaways I had from my chat with Eric. Continuous delivery works for communication, too. Every Friday, Eric would send a small note updating all stakeholders about the progress he had made that week. This allowed him to take stock of what he'd accomplished. That created intimacy with the people involved, making him successful, and it helped him gain momentum in tough times. When you hit a roadblock, take any action. There are no shortage of roadblocks in startup mode. And Eric's team at iGo Digital hit a big one. They had a large client that was having issues, and their team didn't know how to solve it. They had scale problems. With their backs against the wall in a scaling crunch, their head of engineering hopped on a plane to San Francisco to talk through their problem with people he knew. But change didn't happen as a result of those meetings. Instead, change happened because he overheard two random Twitter employees talking about this new database called MongoDB at a coffee shop. He tried it. It fixed their scale problems, and it was in production within days. They became WebScale. Great leaders are constantly replacing themselves. Working in a software startup, it's easy to forget that we're not building software, we're building a company for customers. To scale that company, we can't be the bottleneck. We must continue to grow beyond our jobs and replace ourselves. That's the only way we'll be successful. Resistance is futile. As Eric said, if you're trying to hold on because it's your baby or you want your footprint on it, you're gonna do the organization a disservice. I had a blast talking to Eric today, and now I wanna talk to you. Who are some thoughtful engineering leaders you think I should be interviewing? Email me at wes@woventeams.com or tweet at me @WesWenham. I read every response and I'd love to hear from you.